Chapter 37. Let No Guilty Man Escape. Hardly had the Louisiana furor died down than Grant found his administration descending into a scandal that would eclipse all previous scandals which had soiled individual cabinet members but had not touched the president himself. This new one would widen, surround Grant, and threaten him directly. To finance the war, the Lincoln administration had levied steep taxes on whiskey, and evading those taxes had become a national pastime. Whiskey barons had emerged as major forces in American politics, channeling vast amounts of money to the Democratic Party under Andrew Johnson. "The revenues of the country are in the hands of the enemy," Grant was told during the 1868 campaign, "and the whiskey ring alone can raise, from now until the close of the canvass, $1 million a day, should they need so much for political purposes." In 1868, Congress created internal revenue supervisors to clean up fraud arising from the whiskey tax. Nevertheless, the Treasury Department remained an asylum for corrupt agents who siphoned off money from distillers eager to avoid taxes. The methods of the whiskey ring were fairly straightforward. Distillers would falsify figures of the amount of liquor brewed, and Treasury agents would then certify those bogus returns. The upshot was that in major brewing centers, taxpayers were cheated of millions of dollars in government revenues. The system was perfected in St. Louis, where Grant maintained the White Haven Farm, and where he and Julia thought they might retire. As he explained, he kept close watch on his irregular farm income because it was largely what I must depend on for a support when retired from public duties. In October 1874, Grant attended a St. Louis agricultural fair, and his sentimental homecoming again underscored the indescribable changes in his life since 1860, when he had left the town impoverished. Horace Porter rode over to Hardscrabble with Grant and recorded this fascinating vignette. "When visiting St. Louis with him, he made a characteristic remark showing how little his thoughts dwelt upon those events of his life which made such a deep impression upon others. Upon his arrival, a horse and buggy were ordered, and a drive taken to his farm, about 8 miles distant. He stopped on the high ground overlooking the city, and stood for a time by the side of the little log house which he had built, partly with his own hands, in the days of his poverty and early struggles. Upon being asked whether the events of the past 15 years of his life did not seem to him like a tale of the Arabian Nights, especially in coming from the White House to visit the little farmhouse of early days, he replied, 'Well, I never thought about it in that light.'" Grant's host in St. Louis was his old friend General John McDonald, a former steamboat operator slated to play a notorious part in the upcoming whiskey scandal. Grant had appointed him supervisor for internal revenue for Arkansas and Missouri, with headquarters in St. Louis, but instead of rooting out crooks, McDonald became the kingpin of the local whiskey cabal. For every 70-cent tax dodged on a gallon of whiskey, 35 cents went to the distiller and an equal amount to the ring. These colossal sums propped up Republican politicians in Missouri, shady activity unknown to Grant. Never known for subtlety, McDonald entertained Grant lavishly during his stay, allowing him to use for free an entire floor at a local hotel. While there, Grant entered two of his horses in a competition at the local fair. Shaded by a pagoda in the center of the arena, Grant smoked his cigar and studied the horses. As a connoisseur, he knew the Kentucky thoroughbreds on display far outshone his own horses, and he was resigned to losing. He didn't reckon on McDonald's role as judge. The latter approached Grant's colt and gaudily draped a blue ribbon around its neck. Far from being pleased, Grant was disgusted at the unfairness, a friend recalling that Grant flushed, took his cigar out of his mouth, threw it on the ground, and said in a low voice, "That is an outrage." He turned and walked away. MacDonald also strove to ingratiate himself with Grant by giving him a pair of fast horses equipped with wagon, harness, and gold breastplates engraved with his name. The whiskey ring made sure Grant's aide, Orville Babcock, enjoyed an unforgettable interlude with the blonde Louise Hawkins, nicknamed Sylph. Waxing poetic about her beauty, Babcock said, "She was indeed a sylph and siren, whose presence was like the flavor of the poppy mingled with the perfumes of Araby." Grant told MacDonald that he worried about Republicans losing Missouri, and MacDonald, to remedy that, doled out whiskey funds and patronage jobs to favored politicians. So much whiskey money flowed through his operation that he directed funds to candidates in other states. The ring spread its bribes liberally among Washington insiders, who warned distillers whenever anyone from the Capitol came snooping. Because of Grant's friendship with MacDonald, it was commonly asserted in the St. Louis cabal that the old man knows, meaning Grant. MacDonald fostered this misconception, giving his conspirators an illusory sense of safety, but he alone alleged that Grant knew of these machinations. In June 1874, when Benjamin Bristow became Treasury Secretary, he brought his prosecutorial zeal to bear against the ring. In his robust style, he embarked on a mission to purge the Republican Party of all the rogues that have fastened themselves upon us, and to satisfy the people that we mean to have honest government. That October, when he sent revenue inspectors to St. Louis, somebody in Washington tipped off the ring with an oblique telegram. "Put your house in order. Your friends will visit you." Thus forewarned, the conspirators averted detection. The oracle in the Capitol spoke again to the conspirators on February 3rd. "We have official information that the enemy weakens. Push things. Sylph." It wasn't yet apparent to investigators that the whiskey ring had a Confederate ensconced in a high place, and that his name was Orville Babcock. Grant grew wary of Bristow's crusade, having been warned by Ben Butler that the Treasury Secretary was a self-seeking man who sought publicity to further his own presidential ambitions. By December 1874, Bristow believed Babcock and Secretary of the Interior Delano plotted to oust him. "I am struggling along in the Treasury Department as best I can," he told a friend, "and assure you I find it a very hard place to fill." He was aided by Solicitor of the Treasury Bluford Wilson, brother of General James H. Wilson. Bristow secured a major breakthrough in February when George W. Fishback, publisher of the St. Louis Globe-Democrat, alerted him to a monstrous system of fraud in St. Louis distilleries and promised to supply a well-placed source. Bristow hired a secret agent, Myron Colony, to delve into nefarious doings in St. Louis, while James J. Brooks, assistant chief of the Secret Service, did the same in Chicago and Milwaukee. Before long, Bristow possessed evidence that St. Louis distilleries ran clandestinely at night, paying taxes on only a third of the whiskey they shipped, and similarly incriminating findings cropped up in Chicago, Milwaukee, Louisville, and other brewing centers where millions of gallons of whiskey escaped taxation. The scope of the scandal broadened just as Grant had labored to improve the ethical tone of his administration. On May 7th, Bristow and Wilson sketched for Grant a massive pattern of collusion between distillers and revenue agents, pinpointing MacDonald's central involvement. Suitably appalled, Grant demanded that suspect agents be dismissed and pledged his hearty cooperation. Bristow and Wilson were very heartened. Grant stated that MacDonald had been a friend of his and had grievously betrayed not only that friendship, but the public, Wilson later testified. As to the others, he said they were either knaves or fools, and in either case should go out. When Bristow apprised Grant of imminent plans to seize distilleries in St. Louis, Chicago, and Milwaukee, Grant approved. Although the plan was hatched in strictest confidence, Babcock, writing as Sylph, alerted distillers. Lightning will strike on Monday, he informed St. Louis. Be prepared for it. When the intercepted telegram was returned to Washington, Bristow knew the ring had a Confederate in the upper echelons of the administration, although he didn't yet know the culprit was Babcock. On May 10th, Bristow struck hard at the ring, raiding distilleries and tax offices in St. Louis, Chicago, and Milwaukee. Reams of paper fell into his hands that documented systematic tax evasion and yielded dozens of arrests. Confiscated ledgers confirmed John McDonald as a mastermind of the scheme. He turned up in Washington to try to contain the damage, but when Bristow showed him irrefutable evidence against him, McDonald broke down and admitted to swindling in his district. McDonald resigned his St. Louis post along with John A. Joyce, the local revenue agent. They would be sentenced to 3 and 3.5 years in prison, respectively. The growing scandal mesmerized the Reading public. Investigators started out by interrogating foot soldiers of the conspiracy, distillers, gaugers, and storekeepers, then worked their way up the ladder to internal revenue agents. Bristow confided to a friend that, I am in a fight up to my eyes with tremendous combinations of money and unscrupulous thieves. At first, Grant was angry at McDonald until Babcock persuaded him of his innocence. In late May, Grant told Bristow that there was one honest man, McDonald, upon whom they could rely, as he was an intimate acquaintance and confidential friend of Babcock's. Horrified, Bristow pointed out that McDonald was at the center of the frauds, that he was at this time in New York with $160,000 of money fraudulently obtained, ready to take a steamer on the first indication of any effort to arrest him. By now, Bristow had concluded that Babcock was a thorough scoundrel. Bristow tells me that Babcock is as deep as any in the whiskey ring, Fish wrote, that he has most positive evidence, he will not say of actual fraud, but of intimate relations and confidential correspondence with the very worst of them. An honest man in a corrupt age, Grant could not conceive of such dishonesty by his most confidential aide. When the president withdrew to Long Branch that summer, Orville Babcock was at his side. With his black goatee, handlebar mustache, and suave, insinuating manner, the Vermont-born Babcock was a capable man, having graduated high in his class at West Point, but he was a dangerously devious one. When a newspaper reporter wrote a damning piece about McDonald and Joyce, Babcock reassured McDonald that, I do not believe in joining in abuse of you and Joyce, who have always been kind to me, now that you are in trouble. Babcock's papers at the Newberry Library in Chicago show just how slyly duplicitous he was. Writing 2 years later to his lawyer, Thomas C. Fletcher, Babcock claimed that he thought the legal pursuit of McDonald and Joyce a piece of persecution, and that he had tried to help them all I could and wrote them a few letters and notes, in pencil, I think. He insisted that his letters contained nothing that any honorable mind could misconstrue, but you know how hellish the press is. At the same time, he disclosed that McDonald had a letter from him that might be used to threaten him. Convinced McDonald would part with such letters for a consideration, that is, a bribe, he instructed Fletcher to have McDonald destroy them in your presence, or place them in your possession so that, as attorney, no person can ask them from you. It was a shocking letter. Babcock was advising his lawyer to buy and destroy evidence while pretending to be an innocent soul whose words might be unfairly misconstrued by vindictive reporters. How had such a rascal insinuated himself into Grant's good graces? Even 50 years later, Grant's son Jesse still paid homage to the saintly altruism of Orville Babcock, whom he thought incapable of guile. Never for a moment did father question Colonel Babcock's honesty. We all knew and loved him. He fought under father. He was a member of the family on I Street. Not only would it have been impossible for Colonel Babcock to have been guilty as charged, But Father appreciated just what had happened. Colonel Babcock was the most disinterestedly friendly person I have ever known. His was almost a passion for helpfulness. The slightest acquaintance was sufficient motive for Babcock to respond ardently to any request within his power to grant. He was never so happy as when exerting himself in behalf of his friends, and to Colonel Babcock every acquaintance was a friend. By late July, as a grand jury handed down indictments, Bristow established that the Sylph messages were in the handwriting of Babcock, who had notified MacDonald of upcoming investigations in St. Louis. In one letter, Babcock had told MacDonald that he had intervened to block the probe. "I have succeeded," he wrote. "They will not go. I will write you." Sylph. Around this time, Grant received a letter from a St. Louis friend, William D. W. Barnard, that contained alarming news. The attorney for MacDonald and Joyce had asked him how far he thought prosecutions would proceed, and Barnard, a devout believer in Grant's honesty, replied indignantly, "Until the last man made restitution to his utmost ability to pay and were punished to the extent of the law." The attorney shot back that MacDonald and Joyce had assured him Grant would not give them up or Babcock was lost. When Grant read this, he was outraged at the shocking suggestion that he had subverted justice. He handed the letter to Bristow with a passionate admonition scrawled across it, "Let no guilty man escape if it can be avoided. Be specially vigilant, or instruct those engaged in the prosecutions of fraud to be, against all who insinuate that they have high influence to protect them." Grant couldn't have supplied Bristow with a more invigorating statement. Bristow asked if Grant's statement could be published to silence doubting critics, and when he agreed, it appeared in the Washington Chronicle on August 10th. Bristow warned Grant that efforts were being made to show a want of harmony between them in the whiskey ring prosecutions. "Of course I know how utterly false all such statements are, but it cannot be denied that the frequent repetition of them by parties who profess to have your confidence has done some mischief." Relations between Grant and Bristow worsened after the Treasury Secretary confronted Babcock with a Sylph telegram. A smooth liar, Babcock confessed to having written it, but alleged it was unrelated to the whiskey ring. Bristow told Babcock he would probably be indicted and felt duty-bound to show the president the telegram. When Bristow did so, it was clear Grant had already been bamboozled by Babcock. "It doesn't refer to the whiskey business," Grant said flatly. "It refers to an order for the transfer of a supervisor." "Unfortunately, Mr. President," Bristow noted, "that transfer order was not issued until February 1875, whereas this telegram was sent in December 1874. Even though Bristow predicted that Babcock would be indicted when the grand jury met in St. Louis, Grant refused to force his resignation. Afterward, Bristow bemoaned that Grant was being misled by men who profess friendship for him, but who are acting treacherously. As in the past, Grant identified with the embattled man, worrying more about wrongly accusing an innocent person than pardoning a perfidious one. In September, escorted by Babcock, Grant spent 4 days in St. Louis and was furious to discover that Bluford Wilson had forewarned John B. Henderson, the special counsel there, to keep a close eye on Babcock. The shameless Babcock had no scruples about meeting with John MacDonald. Even Grant met with him, despite the unfortunate impression this might create. Grant received fresh warnings about Babcock's treachery when William L. Burt, the Boston postmaster, told him of a report from Marshal Jewell that Babcock was aiding whiskey ring villains and was a friend of bad men and protected them. He named two prominent men in Washington who, he said, were corrupt, and Babcock was shielding them. Things looked ghastly for the Grant administration in early November, when a St. Louis grand jury pored over names closely associated with the president: his brother Orville, his brother-in-law, Fred Dent, as well as Babcock, prompting Republican talk of a rebel grand jury out to embarrass and discredit the president. On November 29th, U.S. Attorney David P. Dyer notified Attorney General Pierrepont that he was preparing to indict Babcock, adding, "It is painful to me that the President of the United States should be betrayed by those so close to him as General Babcock. I know that there is no one more anxious than the President himself to see the plunderers of the public treasury punished." Grant stood squarely behind the prosecutions, even as they crept closer to his own office. At the same time, he knew the popular Bristow eyed the Republican presidential nomination and feared he was exploiting the Whiskey Ring investigation as a national platform for doing so. On December 3rd, Henderson obtained a conviction of William O. Avery, chief clerk of the Treasury Department. He introduced damaging evidence against Babcock and dragged Grant's name into the fray. "It is very far from the opinion of myself or any of my associates that the President of the United States knew anything about the ring," he said in the courtroom. But he thought that Grant had been grossly deceived and imposed upon by men who professed to be his friends here and in Washington. In an indiscreet closing statement, Henderson came perilously close to accusing Grant of complicity in attempting to halt the Whiskey Ring investigation. "What right has the President to interfere with the honest discharge of the duties of a Secretary of the Treasury? None whatever." When this speech reached Washington, Grant's cabinet reacted with shock, pronouncing it an indecency and an outrage upon professional propriety. For Grant, it represented proof that Henderson was a personal enemy of his and was disposed to abuse him when opportunity offered. According to Fish, the cabinet concurred. The indecency of a counsel specially designated by the president abusing him was severely denounced by all. With Grant's approval, Pierrepont sternly reprimanded Dyer, noting that Grant was not on trial and had imposed no impediments to speedy punishment of the whiskey villains. He instructed him to dismiss the offending Henderson, who was replaced by an able lawyer, James O. Broadhead. With an indictment now looming, Babcock tried to head off trouble by requesting that a military court of inquiry consider his case, and Grant agreed. Everybody knew the consequences if Grant was perceived as tampering with criminal proceedings in St. Louis. Pierrepont gave his opinion that a military inquiry wouldn't interfere with the pending criminal proceedings at St. Louis, which would have been ruinous to Babcock, the president, and the administration. Grant performed an immense favor for Babcock by naming three sympathetic generals, Phil Sheridan, Winfield S. Hancock, and Alfred Terry, to oversee the military inquiry in Chicago, but it was disbanded when St. Louis prosecutors refused to share their evidence against Babcock. On December 9th, Dyer secured a fraud and conspiracy indictment against Babcock. When Babcock insisted that he would be exonerated, Grant clung with a childlike devotion to complete faith in his innocence. On December 17th, he sat down to allay the fears of Babcock's wife, Annie. "My dear Mrs. Babcock, I know how much you must be distressed at the publications of the day reflecting upon the integrity of your husband, and write therefore to ask you to be of good cheer and wait for his full vindication. I have the fullest confidence in his integrity and of his innocence of the charges now made against him. After the intimate and confidential relations that have existed between him and myself for near 14 years, during the whole of which time he has been one of my most confidential aides and private secretary, I do not believe it possible that I can be deceived. It is scarcely possible that he could, if so disposed, be guilty of the crime now charged against him without at least having created a suspicion in my mind. My confidence in General Babcock is the same now as it was when we were together in the field, contending against the known enemies of the government." On Christmas Day, Grant summoned Bluford Wilson, accused him of attempting to have his brother Orville and son Fred indicted for whiskey frauds, and expressed his earnest belief in Babcock's innocence and his sense of the great outrage perpetrated on him, Wilson said. A week later, Chicago and New York newspapers fingered Orville and Fred Grant as involved in the whiskey ring. Indignant at the feeding frenzy in the press and protective toward his family, Grant exploded in fury, saying he had heard enough through talk like this from Treasury officials and wanted it either stopped or proven true. At a cabinet session, he ordered Pierpont to haul reporters before grand juries and force them to substantiate their charges. He said he was prepared to let his brother and son be prosecuted if the rumors proved true, but he strongly questioned their veracity. Treasury officials then confirmed that Orville and Fred Grant bore no connection to the whiskey ring. At this point, Grant took active steps to guard Babcock. In late January, he had the Attorney General issue a circular letter to U.S. attorneys in St. Louis, Chicago, and Milwaukee, advising them not to allow witnesses to turn state's evidence. Granting immunity had formed an essential part of the prosecutions, which would be crippled without them. Grant reiterated his position in a petulant exchange with Bluford Wilson, lecturing him that, "When I said let no guilty man escape, I meant it, and not that nine men should escape and one be convicted." Wilson countered, "Pardon me, Mr. President, we are not in this battle counting heads." As liberal Republicans talked up Bristow for president, Grant regretted that the secretary's zealous young friends promoted his nomination. Bristow now felt a peculiar chill in the air around Grant. Bothered by this, he stopped by Hamilton Fish's home on February 6th for a confidential talk. He recounted how he had gone to Long Branch the previous September to present Grant with his resignation, and Grant had assured him that he was more likely than any one person to be named as his successor, and that there was no one whom he would prefer, and he begged him to take back his resignation, which he did. Since that time, relations with Grant had soured, and the president was now cold, distrustful, and at times offensive and severe in his insinuations and his remarks. Fish urged Bristow not to resign, pointing out that Grant sincerely believed in Babcock's innocence and was persuaded the prosecution of persons who were appointees of his reflected upon the administration. By February 5, 1876, Babcock had checked into a St. Louis hotel along with former Attorney General Williams, who served as his defense counsel. 3 days later, opening arguments began in his trial. Horace Porter tried to convince Grant that his testimony alone could save Babcock from the scoundrels bent on persecuting him. As the trial progressed, Grant's worries about Babcock only deepened when prosecutors introduced evidence showing his secret communications with MacDonald, one ring conspirator even claiming that John Joyce stuffed $500 into an envelope for Babcock and brazenly mailed it to him in the White House. In a cabinet session of extraordinary drama, a distraught Grant said betrayal by Babcock was inconceivable to him. The wounded president submitted to outright paranoia. As recorded by Fish, Grant said that the prosecution was aimed at himself and that they were putting him on trial, that he was as confident as he lived of Babcock's innocence. If Babcock were guilty, he insisted, it would be the basest ingratitude and trickery ever known. Grant not only said he was ready to give a deposition in the case, but stunned the meeting by claiming he wished to travel to St. Louis to testify at once, dragging at least two cabinet members with him. Fish protested that this would place him in the embarrassing predicament of testifying against a case prosecuted by his own administration. The cabinet were unanimous in the opinion that the president ought not to leave Washington during the session of Congress to be made a witness, wrote Fish, and ought not under any circumstances to consent to appear in court as a witness. A flustered Grant then admitted he had already promised Babcock's lawyers he would testify. The cabinet decided he should give a deposition instead, which he did on February 12th before Chief Justice Morrison Waite, an unprecedented step for a president in a criminal proceeding. During the 5-hour deposition, Grant described how he knew Babcock intimately and regarded him as a most efficient and most faithful officer. He denied Babcock had tried to obstruct the Whiskey Ring investigations and would not relent one iota on his innocence. "I have always had great confidence in his integrity, and as yet my confidence in him is unshaken." When Grant was read Babcock's suspicious messages to MacDonald, he disclaimed any knowledge of them at the time and insisted Babcock had explained them to him to his satisfaction. Grant didn't commit perjury, but he did show a willful refusal to open himself up to the facts. At the same time, he repeatedly exhorted Pierpont, "If Babcock is guilty, there is no man who wants him so much proven guilty as I do, for it is the greatest piece of traitorism to me that a man could possibly practice." Despite his epic success in life, an atavistic side of Grant still identified with battered, beaten down, and besieged people, and Orville Babcock now fell into that category of folks worthy of his sympathy. 2 days later, Grant unburdened himself to Hamilton Fish. He thought St. Louis prosecutors were gunning for him, and that Babcock was a convenient decoy as they took dead aim at him. Bristow, he believed, had become possessed with the idea of the complicity of the president and was using his office for the purpose of annoying him. Bristow's colleagues wanted to elevate him to the presidency, and he was yielding to it and allowing himself to be made a party to these proceedings. So persuaded was Grant that personal attacks against him emanated from Bristow's hostile circle that Badeau termed his mood one of the most intense he had ever seen. Persuaded that Grant would dismiss him after Babcock's trial, Bristow pondered his resignation. He had always esteemed Grant a good man motivated by patriotic desire and unselfish devotion to his country, but he believed he had fallen under the potent spell of bad advisers. Now the two men had arrived at an irrevocable break, one that threatened to split the Republican Party. On February 24th, Babcock's trial closed with an acquittal, and many observers believed Grant's affidavit had helped to influence the outcome. The prosecution had suffered under the additional handicap that Babcock's cryptic letters to St. Louis suggested guilt but offered no foolproof evidence. Just when it seemed Grant might be vindicated in his rosy view of Babcock, the gods decided to disabuse him savagely. While Babcock was returning to Washington, Grant received evidence that in 1869 he had invested in gold speculations that ended disastrously with the market crash on Black Friday, losing $40,000 in the transactions. The disclosure that Babcock had connived in tandem with Jay Gould and Jim Fisk devastated Grant. As Bluford Wilson wrote, "The president then, for the first time, comprehended that if Babcock had betrayed him in the Black Friday transactions, he was quite capable of betraying him in connection with the whiskey frauds." Grant had received a sudden and terrible education in misplaced loyalty. As Buck recalled, Grant thought Babcock could not properly come back into his family. Needing someone in whom he could repose a rock-solid trust, a shaken Grant drafted Buck as his secretary to replace Babcock. The scales had fallen much too late from the president's eyes. For a couple of days, Babcock lingered at his White House desk. Horrified to see him there, Fish pleaded with Grant to send him away. On March 1st, Grant finally got rid of him, although Babcock stayed on as superintendent of public buildings in Washington. Exactly a year later, Grant handed him a humiliating assignment, shunting him to the lowly job of inspector for the 5th Lighthouse District, an extraordinary comedown for a man once seated at the throne of power. To sweeten the pill somewhat, Grant wrote to Babcock and assured him of his confidence in his integrity and great efficiency. In 1884, Babcock, age 48, drowned while performing his duties at Mosquito Inlet in Florida. Even though Grant had expelled the serpent from the garden, peace didn't return to the executive mansion. Bristow found the atmosphere irksome and disagreeable, thought Grant remained under Whiskey Ring influence, and decided to resign. According to one story, Bristow tendered Grant his letter of resignation as the president mounted his carriage for a drive. Grant pocketed the envelope in frosty silence and departed. Bristow's letter pulled no punches. It said corrupt people had convinced Grant the prosecutions were really aimed at you and are prompted by a mixture of base and ambitious motives. Utterly false, as I know such statements to be, it is painfully apparent that they are not so regarded by you. He faulted Grant for withdrawal of your confidence and official support. In a decidedly cool reply, Grant accepted Bristow's resignation and hoped he would find that peace in private life denied to anyone occupying your present official position. After Bristow resigned, he was summoned by a congressional committee investigating the whiskey frauds. He declined to appear, citing executive privilege and the confidential nature of cabinet communications. Grant, showing exceptional confidence in his own integrity, urged Bristow to waive executive privilege and testify, declaring his desire not only that you may answer all questions, but wish that all the members of my cabinet may also be called upon to testify in regard to the same matters. Grant refused to surrender his suspicion that Bristow's whiskey crusade was designed to position him as the Republican presidential candidate in 1876. From Fish's diary entries, one can see that Grant's famous composure was breaking down under pressure, and that he had become irritable, short-tempered, and impatient. On October 12th, Fish recorded Grant's astonishing private appraisal of Bristow. Fuming, he described Bristow's nature as one of intense selfishness and ambition, and of extreme jealousy and suspicion, and that from the time he entered the cabinet he had set his eye on the presidency with a distrust and hostility to himself, the president, and to every member of the cabinet. He later repented of this jaundiced, unfair view of Bristow. Grant had succumbed to the curse of second-term presidents, spreading scandal. He himself was never tied to knowledge of the whiskey ring. In fact, his administration had brought more than 350 indictments against the whiskey culprits, an astounding feat for which Grant seldom gets credit. His fault was again one of supervisory judgment rather than personal corruption. The world of politics was filled with duplicitous people, and Grant was poorly equipped to spot them, remaining an easy victim for crooked men. They studied Grant, some of them, as the shoemaker measures the foot of his customer, wrote George Hoare. Many years later, David Dyer issued this verdict. General Grant had no knowledge of the existence of the whiskey ring when the prosecutions began, and therefore was not in the remotest manner a party to, or in any wise connected therewith. His great mistake was in trusting men who did know, and this after their connection with the ring was a matter of common information. Grant was an honest man and implicitly trusted those he believed to be his friends. At no time during the prolonged inquiry was anything discovered that reflected upon General Grant's integrity. In later years, when an acquaintance inquired what had pained him most in the course of his eventful life, Grant responded readily, "To be deceived by a friend." Despite the scandals that had rocked his administration, Grant's wartime heroism clung to him like an honored, if somewhat faded, old cloak, and the American public retained faith in his personal integrity. But he suffered ongoing criticism from liberal Republicans who favored civil service reform, disliked Reconstruction, and were discomfited by his disgraced cabinet members. One unsparing critic remained his steadfast wartime comrade William T. Sherman. In July 1875, the former Interior Secretary Orville Hickman Browning recorded this indictment by Sherman against Grant. "He thought Grant's administration a failure, said the president was very deficient in the qualities of a statesman, that he had no comprehension of the fundamental principles of civil governments, constitutions, and laws, that he had been surrounded by a weak cabinet and had failed to restore harmony and fraternity among the different sections of the country, that a great mistake had been made in putting all the political power of the southern states in the hands of the ignorant, and substantially disfranchising the intelligent classes, and the South was in a worse condition today than at the close of the war." Sherman's views were colored by his close identification with the white Southern establishment he had known and admired before the war. Despite his detractors, Grant remained popular enough to provoke conjecture that he might hazard a run at a third term, defying the two-term custom that had ruled American politics since George Washington. Although stalwart senators prodded him to run, a worn-out Grant demurred. 16 years of public service, he later confided, had exerted a constant strain upon him. His silence on a third term perpetuated so much speculation that Jesse pressed him to issue a statement, opting out of another term. "Do you want me to decline something that has never been offered to me?" Grant asked, smiling sadly. "If the effort is made, I shall refuse to permit my name to be brought before the next national convention. Until then, it would be futile for me to speak." In early 1875, Grant reconsidered this silence amid chatter in Republican circles that a third term might injure the party. When a Republican convention in Pennsylvania approved a resolution opposing a third term, Grant knew he had to issue a categorical denial. To convention president Harry White, he admitted that the fire of personal abuse and slander of his first term had made him seek vindication in the 1872 election. "Now, I am not, nor have I been, a candidate for a renomination." Grant's pledge made newspaper headlines across America. Writing to Edwin Cowles of the Cleveland Leader, Grant showed the same reluctance to seek power that he had manifested after Fort Sumter, when he thought it beneath his dignity to lobby for an army commission. "I left a life position of which I was very proud to accept a first term, very much against my inclination. Twice I have been nominated to the office with great unanimity by conventions convened to make the nomination." It wasn't in his nature to struggle for position, he said, and he would never accept a nomination tendered grudgingly by his party. Grant summoned his cabinet informally to show them his letter to Harry White. When Julia Grant demanded to know the reason for this impromptu gathering, Grant stalled, lit a cigar for courage, then marched into her room, explaining he had just composed a letter squelching rumors he would seek a third term. His wife, he knew, was hell-bent on remaining in the White House, and he was prepared for her wrath. "Bring it and read it to me now," she demanded. "No," he replied, "it is already posted. That is why I lingered in the hall to light my cigar, so the letter would be beyond recall." Julia would gladly have stayed for one more term and had no qualms about scrapping George Washington's precedent. "Oh, Ulyss, was that kind to me?" she protested. "Was it just to me?" "Well," he replied, "I do not want to be here another 4 years. I do not think I could stand it." Rather than feel sympathy for her husband's plight as a profoundly overburdened president, Julia chose to feel deeply injured. She had relished being first lady, as only someone could whose social ambitions had been cruelly mocked during their early years of marriage. In the White House, she had finally attained the grandeur that satisfied her Whitehaven upbringing, and she had radiated pleasure in the spotlight. "She enjoyed her presidential life," observed a guest, "and good-naturedly said so." Julia surely wondered what life would offer without the salary and perquisites that came with the three eminent positions her husband had held since the war. Grant remained an observant Methodist and was never reluctant to profess his faith. In August 1875, he assisted John Hyle Vincent, his former Galena pastor, at the Chautauqua movement of Christian summer camps, addressing a crowd of 30,000. He also attended a revival meeting officiated by Dwight Moody, a leading evangelist. During the 1876 centennial, when asked to supply a statement for Sunday school children, he wrote, "Hold fast to the Bible as the sheet anchor of your liberties. Write its precepts in your hearts and practice them in your lives. To the influence of this book, we are indebted for all the progress made in true civilization." Yet Grant never exploited religion for partisan gain or pandered to the political agenda of any religious group. At a time when some Protestants wanted to Christianize the country and some Catholics lobbied for state funding for parochial schools, he produced a landmark statement reaffirming the separation of church and state. The occasion was a trip in September 1875 to Des Moines, Iowa, where he held an afternoon meeting at Moore's Opera House, greeting 2,500 children who had been cautioned that the visiting president was a man of deeds, not words. The taciturn Grant lived up to his billing, spoke briefly, and spent the rest of the afternoon touring the city with Judge C.C. Cole. As they viewed various schools, they discussed the tremendous strides the nation had made in free public education. The sight of the schoolchildren had stirred some latent impulse in Grant, yearning for expression. That evening, he was scheduled to address an Army of the Tennessee reunion and asked Cole if they might return to his house early so he could jot down some thoughts for his dinner speech. In only 40 minutes, scribbling in pencil, Grant drafted a speech. On the backs of envelopes and the stray scraps of paper at hand in his room, it was a historic plea for public education and the need to save the nation's classrooms from religious interference. Grant started out by emphasizing the importance in a republic of a knowledgeable citizenry. "The free school is the promoter of that intelligence which is to preserve us as a free nation." With an unaccustomed rhetorical flourish, he affirmed that in the near future, the dividing line will not be Mason and Dixon's, but between patriotism and intelligence on the one side, and superstition, ambition, and ignorance on the other. He wound up with an eloquent appeal for separating church and state. "Encourage free schools and resolve that not $1 of money appropriated to their support, no matter how raised, shall be appropriated to the support of any sectarian school. Leave the matter of religion to the family circle. The church and the private school supported entirely by private contribution. Keep the church and state forever separate." Some observers construed the speech as a transparent attack on the Catholic Church, and one Catholic periodical said Grant sought to ostracize Catholics socially and disenfranchise them politically. Thomas Nast drew a cartoon that showed Grant smoking a cigar as he coolly stepped on the foot of a prelate crossing the church-state divide. Many Catholics supported the speech, however, which proved so popular in Iowa that it revived Republican Party fortunes there. Traveling elsewhere in Iowa, Grant proselytized for a wider agenda to promote public education. When asked about state support for higher education, he endorsed it as long as free, universal education was provided for younger children, elementary schools being the system's cornerstone. Doubtless with Reconstruction in mind, Grant advanced a broader vision of free education as the most effective means to assimilate immigrant masses and heal lingering wartime wounds. Students should be taught that, while loving the home state, they should love the country more. Hard sectional feelings should give way to brotherly love for the whole American family. In his annual message to Congress that December, Grant embroidered this theme of the need for mass public education to resist tyranny and oppression, whether directed by the demagogue or by priestcraft. Educating the citizenry, he asserted, was the optimal way to protect democratic institutions. Making a dramatic leap, he advocated a constitutional amendment that would require each state to establish and forever maintain free public schools adequate to the education of all the children, irrespective of sex, color, birthplace, or religions. Forbidding the teaching in said schools of religious, atheistic, or pagan tenets, and prohibiting the granting of any school funds or school taxes in aid of any religious sect or denomination. Grant worded his message to remove any suspicion that he spoke for a particular religious denomination. Also buried in his statement was a courageous, far-sighted plea for free, universal education for black children. The laconic Grant's crusade for public education was a unique event in his presidency, the result of a riveting speech that had forced an issue on the national consciousness through powerful oratory. Even as Grant's entourage rolled through western states, violence against Republicans flared up again in the Deep South. The target of terror continued to be black citizens who had the temerity to exercise their voting rights. On September 4th, Mississippi Republicans threw an alfresco barbecue in Clinton, west of Jackson, scheduled to rally voters in upcoming elections. Intruders from a White Line rifle club showed up to harass them, murdered a black citizen, then opened fire on other blacks, who quickly grabbed pistols and returned fire. The gunfight left 7 or 8 blacks sprawled dead in the dust, with 3 white men killed in retaliation. William H. Harney, sheriff of Hinds County, reported to Governor Adelbert Ames that the incident stemmed from squads of white men bushwhacking through the countryside, murdering and driving the colored people from their homes. The colored people are unarmed and defenseless. I appeal to Your Excellency to stop this slaughter of an innocent and defenseless people. Local law enforcement seemed powerless to curb the cresting wave of white violence. On September 7th, Ames pleaded with Grant for federal help, noting that illegal bands of armed white men were sowing terror in several counties and boldly defying sheriffs. Grant acted decisively to stanch this violence, telling his adjutant general, "You may instruct commanding officer of troops in Mississippi that he may assist the governor in maintaining order and preserving life in case of insurrection too formidable for him to suppress." Then, on vacation in Long Branch, Grant began to dither in an uncharacteristic fashion. In the altered political climate, with Northern support for Reconstruction waning, he agonized over the legality of intervention and sought the opinion of his conservative Attorney General, Edwards Pierpont, who urged inaction, unfurling the banner of states' rights. Meanwhile, Mississippi Democrats blandly assured Washington of the absence of any violence. "There are no disturbances in this state," the Democratic Executive Committee told Pierpont, "and no obstructions to the execution of the laws." Pierpont believed the federal government should act only if state forces failed to quell the bloodshed. On September 11th, he sent Grant a soothing message that state authorities had no difficulty in putting down the riot, and that the sending of federal troops would do great mischief. I am satisfied that the war is over. This was an extreme case of Panglossian thinking. When Pierpont inquired of Ames if an uncontrollable insurrection existed, he confirmed that was the case. Ames knew a pivotal moment had arrived and that Northern opinion had given up on protecting freed people. Sticking to his convictions, he made a forthright political stand. "I am aware of the reluctance of the people of the country to national interference in state affairs. Permit me to express the hope that the odium of such interference shall not attach to President Grant or the Republican Party. Let the odium in all its magnitude descend upon me. I cannot escape the conscious discharge of my duty toward a class of American citizens whose only offense consists in their color. On September 13th, Grant composed a long, handwritten letter to his Attorney General. He had to decide whether to issue a proclamation and send troops to Mississippi. He seemed poised on a knife edge, torn between popular revulsion against Reconstruction and his fervent wish to aid threatened blacks. He admitted to being perplexed as to the ideal course of action. The whole public are tired out with these annual autumnal outbreaks in the South, and the great majority are ready now to condemn any interference on the part of the government. But having noted that he didn't intercede lightly in Southern affairs, he came down forthrightly for intervention. I do not see how we are to evade the call of the governor if made strictly within the Constitution. Grant showed a painstaking concern for the constitutional propriety of such a move. At the same time, to mollify critics, he encouraged Ames to exhaust all state resources before receiving federal help. Whatever his misgivings, Grant wanted to rescue Ames and the black people of Mississippi, even if it meant defying his Attorney General. He was fully prepared to risk the political backlash against Reconstruction. His letter written, Grant departed for a veterans' reunion in Utica, New York, leaving the matter to Pierpont, who sent Ames a message that substituted his own conservative judgment for the president's, while pretending he and Grant acted in unison. He struck out a line saying that Grant had agreed to an intervention proclamation. Instead, he chastised the Mississippi governor for not having proven the existence of an insurrection, the legal requirement for sending troops, or taken sufficient steps to stop the violence on his own, a rebuke that left Ames feeling disgusted and quite exasperated. The letter concluded that, if there is such a resistance to your state authorities as you cannot, by all the means at your command, suppress, the president will swiftly aid you in crushing these lawless traitors to human rights. 2 days later, Pierpont advised Grant that the federal government should back off. No proclamation needed, he counseled. Grant approved the suggestion, which he would regret as the single greatest error he made during Reconstruction. He shortly departed on his western trip, leaving Pierpont in charge. One wonders whether, had he stayed in Washington, the Mississippi crisis might have unfolded differently. Although Ames decided to raise a volunteer company of black and white militia, white-liners decided to scare blacks from the polls and install a democratic government through naked terror, if necessary. The black community in Vicksburg conjured up their lawless methods in a letter to the governor. They are going around the streets at night dressed in soldiers' clothes and making colored people run for their lives. They are drilling every night with the wharf boat guns. They have got 2,000 or 3,000 stand of arms here in this city. They say they will either carry this election by ballot or bullet. Ames surmised that Democrats and their white line allies would temporarily lay low to forestall any proclamation from the president. It is believed that white liners will delay violence till 1 or 2 days before election, he apprised Grant. The white liners didn't bother with any such pretense of civility or restraint. On October 7th, John Milton Brown, the sheriff of Coahoma County, reported a perfect state of terror had seized his jurisdiction. I have been driven from my county by an armed force. I am utterly powerless to enforce law or to restore order. Disheartened by Grant's refusal to rush troops to Mississippi, Ames sat brooding and besieged in the governor's mansion in Jackson. He concluded that Reconstruction was a dead letter, white supremacists in his state having engineered a coup d'etat. Yes, a revolution has taken place, by force of arms, and a race are disfranchised. They are to be returned to a condition of serfdom, an era of second slavery, he lamented to his wife. Sarcastically referring to Grant's and Pierpont's words, he wrote, "The political death of the Negro will forever release the nation from such political outbreaks. You may think I exaggerate. Time will show you how accurate my statements are." To head off threatened impeachment, he decided to resign after the election. His darkly prophetic letter previewed the nearly century-long Jim Crow system that would cast blacks back into a state of involuntary servitude to southern whites. Ames worked hard to effect a truce between white Democrats and white and black Republicans in his state, and even offered to strip black militia of their weaponry if Democrats respected black voting rights in the November elections. Attorney General Pierpont dispatched to Mississippi George K. Chase, who moved into the governor's mansion to arbitrate the bloody dispute. On October 16th, Ames thanked Pierpont for his timely assistance, saying that Chase has succeeded in inspiring us all with confidence and, by his wisdom and tact, has saved the state from a catastrophe of blood, news that drew relieved sighs from Grant and his cabinet. But Chase was hornswoggled by Southern Democrats. White liners had cynically suspended violence during Ames's peace conference, and he was frank enough to admit it. On October 27th, he alerted Pierpont that it would be impossible to have a fair election on November 2nd without the aid of U.S. troops. Grant and Pierpont, having fatally wavered, had failed to quash the campaign of intimidation that left black and white Republicans cowering across Mississippi. With Chase's blunt warning in hand, Grant and Pierpont now belatedly sent troops to Mississippi to ensure fair elections, holding them ready for swift deployment in the event of Election Day disorder. Far from being uplifted by this news, Ames dismissed it as too little too late. "The election ceases to have any interest for us," he told his wife. "It is lost, gone forever. The Republican candidate for the presidency next year may want this state, but he as well might want the moon for a toy." The violence on Election Day vindicated Ames's dire scenario. As he informed his wife, "The reports which come to me almost hourly are truly sickening. Violence, threats of murder, and consequent intimidation are coextensive with the limits of the state. Republican leaders in many localities are hiding in the swamps or have sought refuge beyond the borders of their own counties. The government of the U.S. does not interfere, and will not, unless to prevent actual bloodshed." Democrats emerged triumphant in the state, boasting that they had rooted out malfeasance and bad government. Even Hiram R. Revels, the first black U.S. senator from Mississippi, applauded the outcome as a victory over corruption, theft, and embezzlement. And he wasn't the only black official who complained that Ames had surrounded himself with mercenary officials. Still, there was little doubt that the Democrats had won by crushing black turnout. In Yazoo County, only 7 Republican votes were cast in a black population that exceeded 12,000. Ames saw the election as a referendum on race, pure and simple. In one phrase, hostility to the Negro as a citizen. The South cares for no other question. Everything gives way to it. They support or oppose men, advocate or denounce policies, flatter or murder, just as such action will help them as far as possible to recover their old power over the Negro. He scoffed at Grant's hollow promise to send troops as a sham, and the election a fraud. The election had mocked the U.S. Constitution and guaranteed a prolonged night of terror for freed people. When a Senate committee investigated the election, it decided it had been won by the Democrats by a preconceived plan of riots and assassinations, in the words of Senator George Boutwell. Why had Grant retreated so shamefully from Reconstruction in the final stages of his administration? Again and again he had declared southern counties in a state of insurrection and sent federal troops to protect black citizens. His actions had been courageous, exemplary. The solution to this mystery came years later from John Roy Lynch, the sole black Mississippi congressman to survive the Democratic onslaught in the state. A rousing orator, the biracial Lynch was the son of a white plantation master and an enslaved woman. Almost 40 years afterward, living in Chicago, he told of a talk at the White House in November 1875. When he asked Grant why he had refused action in Mississippi, he had replied that as soon as Ames's plea for succor came in early September, he had prepared to issue a proclamation for action in Mississippi, something confirmed by Grant's own papers. Before signing it, however, he conferred with Ohio Republicans who warned that if Grant intervened in Mississippi, Republicans would lose Ohio elections on October 13th, the state having already lost faith in Reconstruction. Grant decided it was more important to retain Ohio than save Mississippi. Republicans won the Ohio elections, returning Rutherford B. Hayes to the governorship and setting the stage for the next president. "I should not have yielded," Grant told Lynch. "I believed at the time I was making a grave mistake, but as presented it was duty on one side and party obligation on the other. Between the two, I hesitated, but finally yielded to what I believed was my party obligation. If a mistake was made, it was one of the head and not of the heart." Grant's personal tragedy was simultaneously an American tragedy. Tormented by his decision, steeped in a meditative mood, Grant reflected on the deep changes wrought in Northern Republican circles. He predicted to John Roy Lynch that the Northern retreat from Reconstruction would lead to Democrats recapturing power in the South, as well as future mischief of a very serious nature. "It requires no prophet to foresee that the national government will soon be at a great disadvantage, and that the results of the War of the Rebellion will have been, in a large measure, lost. What you have just passed through in the state of Mississippi is only the beginning of what is sure to follow. I do not wish to create unnecessary alarm, nor to be looked upon as a prophet of evil, but it is impossible for me to close my eyes in the face of things that are as plain to me as the noonday sun." This wasn't a minor statement. The victorious Union general of the Civil War was saying that terror tactics perpetrated by Southern whites had nullified the outcome of the rebellion. All those hundreds of thousands dead, the millions maimed and wounded, the mourning of widows and orphans, all that suffering, all that tumult, on some level, had been for naught. Slavery had been abolished, but it had been replaced by a caste-ridden form of second-class citizenship for Southern blacks. And that counted as a national shame.